Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Now it's time for us to listen to you. Voice your opinions and provide feedback about public radio at nprlistens.org. Your input helps NPR's efforts to bring you the news and stories that matter. Have a say at nprlistens.org. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we visit with a very well-received and very well-reviewed film about building and destroying, The Lego Movie. Then, in honor of a teenage character, we'll talk about some of our favorite teenage characters. And as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I dabble in the vicinity of movies and TV and theater and that sort of thing.
I love how Trey changes it every week. And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
We are here this week, first off, to talk about The Lego Movie. Now, the basic gist of The Lego Movie, without giving too much away, is that there is a regular Lego guy, Emmett, who gets pulled into this plot of whether he is meant to participate in this great adventure.
He's basically Kung Fu Panda.
To, you know, because, of course, you got to recover the MacGuffin of the Lego Movie. Is he the one? And it's kind of
one of these. Well, they call him the special. They're clearly commenting on those cliches.
And it's one of these stories that sort of is all about whether he is going to rise to the challenge of defeating a character played by Will Ferrell, who appears as President Business.
Bad Cop is waiting for you in your office.
Wonderful. Fantastic. Would you cancel my 2 o'clock? This next meeting could run a little bit deadly.
And it's taking place in a universe that is made of Legos
and
is divided into various realms through which they travel.
I don't want to pat myself on the back, although I do. But a few weeks ago on this show, I mentioned that I had watched a whole bunch of previews for a whole bunch of movies, and they were all unbelievably disheartening except for the preview for The Lego Movie, which I thought looked really good. And you know what? It's really good. I thought it was really good, but I don't know. We'll have to see what other people think. Stephen, what did you think of The Lego Movie?
You know, I was actually not dazzled by the preview for The Lego Movie. You were so excited about it. You came in here bubbling about it. I didn't want to harsh your mellow. I freaking loved The Lego Movie.
Yes.
I could not believe how much I loved The Lego
Movie. Well, you are a well-known advocate of Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs.
Right, and it's the same writers and directors,
Phil Lord
and Chris Miller, who are both, like, dudes in their late 30s. They're,
And they did Clone High, and they did the 21 Jump Street movie, and
Do I need to see the 21 Jump Street movie?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's a lot of fun.
They have a pretty good history of things that come out better than they sound like they would be. And I think this is one.
That really does seem to be a through line through their career. I just found it incredibly imaginative in every way. I mean, the things that it takes that are very conventional, some of the lessons that it imparts that are lifted straight out of Toy Story 2, lifted straight out of Kung Fu Panda. Every time,
I'm always with the Kung Fu Panda.
I love me a Kung Fu Panda. For everything it did that was very conventional, it would then kind of slap you with a twist. It was like taking those formulas and feeding them through the mind of Charlie Kaufman.
Sure.
Yeah.
And so it maintained the capacity, on one hand, to be a completely joyful and, you know, just a romp, but also to be so smart at the same time.
You said Charlie Kaufman. What it's really kind of doing is what Legos and kids do. It's putting those ideas and mashing them up inside the brain of a kid who might very well be highly sugar-fueled.
Right. I think that's right.
Friends of mine didn't want to go see this, and they didn't go see it because it's going to be an ad for Legos. Why would I go and pay money to see an ad for Legos?
I was guilty of this.
We're going to go see Monuments Men.
Suckers.
How'd that work out for you?
Yeah.
Man, this was a lot of fun. And so much of the charm of this film. I mean, like, I love that there were lots of jokes. Lots and lots and lots of jokes. I also love that the casting plays a huge part in this film because to an actor, everyone who is in this film seems to be commenting on their public personas
in one way
or the other.
That's true.
So Chris Pratt is basically playing the Chris Pratt of Andy's Chris Pratt from Parks and Recreation, none more so than Morgan Freeman.
Don't worry about what the others are doing. You must embrace what is special about you.
basically parodying the Morgan Freeman role.
It's really true.
Well, Nick and Offerman is a mecha pirate with a shark for an arm. And sort of how I picture Nick Offerman in his free time.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing about this, and those of you who have listened to me talk about superhero movies before will know this about me. You might remember my saying at one point that all I really want is a movie that's like, okay, there's a box and everyone's trying to get it.
Right.
Shut up. I believe you. I don't need 15 minutes of explanation of what the box is for. Just tell me. Everyone wants the box. There's a moment in this movie where somebody is explaining about the box and somebody else's brain is just literally is saying blah, blah, blah.
Checking out.
And I thought, it's my people. Because ultimately, in a movie like this, every minute that you spend explaining why the box is important is a minute that you are not spending telling jokes.
Right. Yeah.
And there are so many good jokes in this movie, big jokes, little jokes, visual jokes. And that way, it's very much like Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs when we talked about that. There's
just
stuff.
It's a fusillade, an avalanche.
There's just stuff going on all the time. And they make, I think, when you talk about it being an ad for Legos, I think they make great use of the fact that it's Legos in a few different ways. You know, the very imaginative use of Legos to represent water and things like that. Mm-hmm. But also the fact that because it's Lego, they have the rights to all these bizarre, and that's why you get these mashups.
Star Wars
of
jokes.
Like,
throwaway Star Wars jokes.
And you never get that. Like, you never get throwaway Star Wars jokes because nobody has the rights. And so you have throwaway Star Wars jokes. You have, like, one minute you're looking at Abraham Lincoln, and another minute you're looking at Shaquille O'Neal, and it's very, it's just very funny how all those things get mushed up together, and the only place in which they exist is Lego.
The critic, Andrew Wheeler at Comics Alliance, a site that I've talked about before, beat me to it. He said that this is one of the best Batman films ever.
Relax, everybody, I'm here. Batman! What's up, babe?
Babe!
What?
Oh, sorry, Batman, this is Emmett. Emmett, this is my boyfriend, Batman.
I'm Batman.
He is absolutely right, because that is Batman. Like, if he was existed in real life or plastic life, he would be kind of a macho jerk who would listen to death metal that he composed about how he is an orphan.
And in a way, he's not only playing off of the Will Arnett person. I mean, he's basically Job as Batman.
Yes.
Right up to and including writing a song about himself to be played while he is being himself.
Yep. It does neatly avoid the DreamWorks trap. You think when there's going to be so many jokes, we're going to get at least some sort of ham-fisted pop culture references that are going to go away, like, you da ant. We don't have any of that. None of that. It's just jokes that work, that are based on character, that are based on, like, interplay. It's it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. It's interesting because the one way to look at this movie, obviously, is it is just a big commercial for Legos. You know, it's an animation of a capitalist product and all that stuff. But Lego is something that, to me, exists. There's a point where a toy passes over from just its branded self as a product into a cultural thing that exists as a cultural thing in addition to a commercial thing. And that's very dicey to talk about because there's plenty of material about how things are marketed to kids, and I get all that stuff. But Legos have memory and sort of emotion attached to them for people, in the same way that toy trains or
Lincoln Logs
or, I mean, if you made a Lincoln Logs movie, it's like
it would be so boring.
That should totally happen. Lincoln Logs movie would be great. If you made a Lincoln Logs movie, on the one hand, you're saying go buy Lincoln Logs. But on the other hand, you are talking about a real thing that means something to people.
Yes.
And so to me, it's no more offensive than making a movie about checkers, even though checkers are generic, than Legos. Lego is one of those things that indeed, just as you say, has passed through all these different incarnations. And one of the things I like about it, I think you can say without giving away too much of the movie, that the message of the movie is very much that there is in life a place for planning and cooperation and structure, and a place for letting your freak flag fly, as it were, for in the world of Legos.
Yeah, in a sense, it's basically critiquing everything I despise about Legos, except for the price. At no point is there a message in the movie that Legos are ridiculous. needlessly way too expensive. In a way, to the extent that it advertises Legos, it's advertising almost like go get a big bucket of random Lego pieces.
Sure. What this film made me want to do was not go out and buy Legos, but go and play some of the Lego video games, which are a lot of fun. So, Linda Holmes, you should, if you enjoyed this movie, as I mentioned before, the same sensibility, not the same jokes, but the same sensibility is evinced by, and you can pick whichever franchise you want, because they've made a Lego video game about it, but they're a lot of fun.
Yeah. I mean, there was a little bit of talk when this movie started to get really good reviews. There was a lot of talk about, is it really this good? Is this hive mind stuff? And I thought, well, okay.
I cannot enjoy this movie. What can I do to squash others' enjoyment
right.
of this movie?
Right. And I thought there's a couple things going on, I think, in terms of the sort of startling unanimity with which critics embraced this movie. Mm-hmm. And I think one of those things is obviously it's February. And
right. Everybody's dying for a decent
movie. For a new decent movie to come out in February is, you know, not unheard of, but unusual. And right now, everybody is kind of clearing the decks of all of the big, important Oscar movies they need to see. And to have this sort of explode onto the scene is an interesting thing. And I think the other thing is that it becomes hard for people to remember sometimes that a giant machine that does not necessarily discriminate in favor of quality also does not necessarily discriminate against quality,
yeah,
meaning that you can get a bunch of people together who just want to make movies and make a ton of money.
Mm-hmm.
And every now and then, when you get them in a room, they will create something really joyful and wonderful.
That really works.
That really works, because even though your system is not well designed to make quality only, that doesn't mean it can't make quality.
Sure.
Well, I enjoyed the fact that the way this movie was made, I was reading up not only how much it made, which was a fortune, but how much it cost, which was comparatively very little compared to virtually every major studio's animated movie. This movie cost $60 million to make.
Wow, and it made well more than that just domestically.
Just in the first weekend.
In the first weekend.
Now, you know, part of that apparently is like a lot of the details of your Pixar movies where they're animating every hair on each monster's body. They don't have to do that because they've turned a weakness into a strength.
Yep.
And this limitation in the way the characters move, they keep them moving the way Legos move and actually getting jokes out of that.
Mm-hmm.
The
right.
way this movie turns weaknesses into strengths all the way through, the fact that it's a Lego movie is a strength. The fact that it's animated less expensively turned into a strength.
Yeah. And I got to circle back to Chris Pratt for just a second, who everybody knows I love Chris Pratt. I think from the opening of the movie where Emmett is getting out of bed, I kept wanting to be watching film of Pratt doing this voiceover work.
Good morning, apartment. Good morning, doorway. Morning, wall. Morning, ceiling. Good morning, floor. Ready to start the day. Here it is. Instructions to fit in, have everybody like you, and always be happy. Step one, breathe. Okay, got that one down. Step two, greet the day, smile, and say,
good morning, city!
And he's so goofy. He has such enormous warmth when he does this stuff that I think the way that character become so lovable and sweet really does come back to that performance, which I think is great.
And don't you think that they created the character around him in a way? It certainly feels like this is not just a work that he went in and read the lines.
Well, they either created it around him or they created it thinking that they were going to create the Lego version of Chris Pratt and then get whoever to voice it, and they just were able to get him. You know what I mean? Like,
that's what I feel about Will Arnett as Batman. That's the way I feel about Liam Neeson as Bad Cop.
Yeah.
And Good Cop.
What ultimately I took away from this film was, you know, we've talked recently on the show about meta and how to do meta. And this movie has a bunch of meta jokes in it. And it walks that perfectly fine line of being meta without really taking you out of the movie and without ever being arch or mean eye-rolling about it. And in part, Linda, you said about Chris Pratt. Chris Pratt being the gee whiz, aw shucks, heart and soul of this movie is so important. This is such a likable film.
Yeah.
The only missed opportunity for meta I could think of when I came out of this thing was I really wanted to see one of the Lego characters in some kind of domestic situation step on a teeny tiny little piece of Lego and go, ow, 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 ow.
Oh, that's good. That's a good one.
That's good. That's in the sequel, man.
Or maybe suck it up in a vacuum cleaner.
And we should say, there is a bunch of stuff in this movie that I would love to talk about more that we're not going to talk about because it's kind of spoilery. What I will say about it is, I want now to go back and watch this movie again, knowing those things about it and kind of having seen all that stuff, because I have a feeling that if you see it a second time, it's even more clever in the way they've built it into the story. And so I'm kind of eager to see it again with an eye toward the way the story ultimately resolves itself.
I absolutely think that this is going to be one of those movies, like the Meatballs movies, that you can watch once a year and find jokes that you miss.
Yeah, I felt myself missing tiny jokes. At one point, I turned over to steal a nacho from my daughter, and I hear the word Milhouse going by, like, I missed Milhouse! And then scanned the screen for the next, like, minute and a half waiting for them to show Milhouse again.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH and tell us what you thought of the Lego movie. And feel free, if you did not like the Lego movie, tell us, because, you know, I am interested in what might not have appealed to people about it if it didn't. And, you know, because there has been a lot of praise, and I'm always interested in hearing how people see it from all sides. So let us know what you thought. Now, in our next segment this week, we were animated by the fact, as it were, that our pal Stephen Thompson will very soon be the father of a teenager. We thought that we would talk about some of our favorite teenage characters. Now, I was sort of responsible for foisting the hugeness of this topic on everyone and saying, how about we do teenage characters? And then as I started to actually think about them, I thought, well, you know, that's awfully broad. I will give Stephen pride of place. And why don't you talk to me about a teenage character too, Stephen?
Well, I actually want to start with one of those larger topics. And talk about how many portrayals of teenage life, particularly early teenage life, I'm talking more, you know, junior high into high school than high school into college, and how fairly routine it is to make those characters as miserable as possible and make them as angst-ridden as possible and to really try to capture a lot of the shock and awe and horror of being a teenager. And what I wonder is that inflated? In a sense, because that art is being made by people who are remembering a particularly tortured adolescence and kind of sifting out some of the joys of being young, if we go too far in portraying teenage life as miserable. And an example I want to throw out there is like Miley Cyrus was this incredibly poised and articulate and seemingly well-balanced teenager. And then once she was an adult, like adulthood was what was hard.
So you're wondering whether our mythology of young teenagerhood is overly dark.
Yeah, if we assume now, and we all, I think, to varying degrees had some difficult times as teenagers. But I just wonder if the portrayals that should stand out, if ones that are a little more assured, aren't a little bit truer to what it's like to be a teenager.
Glenn is making a face that I would call, it's so much worse than anyone ever says it is.
Well, I mean, I was coming at it from exactly the opposite point of view, because it seems to me like the young adult fiction or movies or stuff that I gravitate toward are the kind that deal in fantasy, where the travails of adolescence are metaphors. So Buffy, for example, or Harry Potter. Actually, specifically, the one character I was going to shout out is Lyra Balakwa from the Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials trilogy. Just such a great character and such a great, fully realized person. Because it strikes me that teenagers struggle. What they're struggling to do is define who they are. And for a lot of nerds and for a lot of athletes, I would imagine, they can define themselves by what they love. But at a certain point, you have to define yourself as to what you're against. And in your case, Stephen, it was comics.
I was against comics.
And in my case, it was football, because we have to kind of create ourselves in this period of time. All of a sudden, writers started writing more cinematically as films kind of came about in the 20s and 30s and 40s. I think in a lot of the young adult stuff that I've read recently, you can feel the effect of the Disney Channel on this on this fiction. There is a bubbliness, there's safety. Everything is couched in a wisecrack. Everything is the stakes aren't really there the way it used to be for things like, you know, Flowers in the Attic, for example. There are some stakes there. I'm not comparing iCarly to Flowers in the Attic, but I wouldn't be the first. But like the Percy Jackson series, when you see that film, when you read those books, you come away thinking this could have been a miniseries on the Disney Channel because it just feels so safe. There's this tone in a lot of the stuff, the jokes that are recycled in a lot of young adult fiction, like, she's standing behind me, isn't she? Like that. Or, so we could probably die and die horrible flaming deaths. Let's do it. Like, those jokes are just recycled so much, I don't feel like the stakes are there. And for something like Harry Potter, for something like Buffy, death is a metaphor for just how crappy it is.
Yeah. Right. How about you, Trey? What do you think?
I'm going to lean a little bit towards Stephen in this conversation. I think that because stories tend to get told by creative people, and many creative people go through a dark, dark period during adolescence, I think there's a, not a filter, but whatever the opposite of a filter is, there's a pall that gets thrown over these stories. And because I know plenty of perfectly well-adjusted teenagers.
But I don't know. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, Linda, you have said before, and I think I've even quoted you saying this on this show, that history isn't written by the winners, it's written by the writers.
Yes.
And if nothing else, you don't necessarily get as rich and diverse a sheer amount of different kinds of portrayals of teenagers. There's sort of this assumption, it's either this fantasy portrayal of an incredibly confident, you know, heroic kid, or the kid is just miserable and angry.
Or the guy who manages to defy authority and get away with it. I mean, you're Ferris Bueller's and whatnot.
Sure.
Right. I think for me, the challenge of writing teenagers, and this is true in books, it's true in movies, it's true in television, the challenge of writing teenagers is sort of exactly what Glenn said, which is it can feel, when you are dabbling around in things that as an adult no longer feel important, like who is going to be willing to be your friend and stuff like that, it is easy to feel like there are no stakes. Right. And there are a couple of different solutions to that. One is to write really good teenagers in books like The Hunger Games and Buffy, things that do have metaphorical stakes. The other is to become one of these kinds of shows or movies or books that is great at balancing how really difficult it is to be a teenager with an understanding of the fact that these are teenager problems. Mm-hmm. And without condescending to them, understanding how enormously difficult it is. And that, for me, is one of the things that appeals about a show like My So-Called Life, which it really did remain in a pretty darn realistic world of teenagers and what their problems and issues were. But as I've talked about on this show before, there is an incident in that show that is a busting up between best friends that is as wrenching and sad and upsetting as anything in a kind of adult serious drama kind of book. I felt the same way about Freaks and Geeks.
Yeah.
It was like that too, where you felt the importance of these small moments, and they were very good at conveying that, yes, these are things that an adult will say to you 20 years from now, you won't care. Mm-hmm. And you have to be kind of honest about that, and honest about the fact that teenagers deal with a lot of things that seem, as an adult, like, I wish those were my problems. But be honest and fair about the fact that when you are 13, 14, 15, these things are almost overwhelmingly difficult to deal with and difficult to trust anybody to talk about. And so things like My So-Called Life, things like Freaks and Geeks, I feel this way about the book Eleanor and Park, which I've also talked about a bunch of times. It is that balance between they are teenager problems and you recognize that the angst over them is somewhat specific to the age.
Sure.
But you take it seriously. The pain and the hurt and the worry are genuine, and you know you should respect them while understanding that, you know, it's different stuff than you're going to be facing when you're 30 and 40.
Well, I take your points. I think where that cliche of the surly teen comes from is exactly that. An adult overstating what teenager felt like by turning characters into these horrible emo mopes who hate the world. It's endemic. It's on...
Glenn, you have talked about your hatred of the surly teen archetype.
It's on Homeland. It's everywhere. And all they do is define themselves against what's around them, which is, you know, it's a trick of characterization. You create a character by saying what they're against. That's fine. But if that's all that is, then you have a very annoying character.
Yeah. I mean, even a great show like Breaking Bad, one of the running jokes about that show is that the teenage son pretty much just shows up for breakfast and is not, especially in the early parts of that show, in the early seasons of that show, is not terribly well defined because people have a lot of difficulty figuring out how to integrate a teenager with the rest of a show that's not about them, that's about what's going on with adults.
And so much of being a teenager is pulling apart from the world around you. Yeah. And you know, I've often said about having kids and raising kids that think of your kid, you take their age and think of it as a fraction over the number 18. And so my son is about to be 13 18ths of an adult. Uh-huh. You know, in some ways and not others, he's 13 18ths of the way out the door. You know, as much as a lot of the day-to-day of, oh, high school, so-and-so talked to me, so-and-so didn't talk to me, as much as those seem very small, they're really not that different from adult problems. I'm not that different at 41 than I was at 13. I mean, in virtually every way.
I think a very differently toned example from a lot of the ones that we've been talking about is, you know, for a lot of people, the fourth season of The Wire is the best season. It's the one that dealt with the school system. And one of the things that I've always really respected about the way that they went about writing and creating that season was to say, look, if you're going to do a show about the school system, it can't be all, you know, parents and
funding and curriculum.
Even though they deal with that stuff, you know, they deal with the administrative stuff and the bureaucracy because that's kind of where that show is coming from, is systems. But they clearly understood if you're going to do the school system, you got to have kids. You got to understand these are the real kids. And they created several young boys, and they were individual kids. They have individual personalities. You have individual worries for them. And those are exceptionally, I think, well-written kids simply because it resisted the urge to sentimentalize them or their lives or to simplify what they were dealing with and to understand, like, these kids at this age, at 14 or 15, they're the same people who are going to be the 23 and 24 and 26 and 30-year-olds who this show has been dealing with all along. And so I think sometimes you that continuity of understanding a teenager as an adult in the making can also be a very, very valuable thing.
My example is Kamala Khan. She is the main character in a brand new comic series that just started last week called Ms. Marvel. Kamala Khan is a Muslim American of Pakistani descent who lives in Jersey City. She sees herself as a American high school kid. Her parents are very conservative, and yet her family is conservative in different ways. And she struggles because she is a teenager, and it's a book about a teenager, but she struggles not with her faith, but with her culture. It's written by G. Willow Wilson, who's a Muslim American. And she chose to make this book so smart. And, for example, the mean girl that she goes up against in this book in high school, because this is not really a superhero book. This is a high school. You get a character study of this girl, is not a mean girl particularly. She is a very Anglo, blonde, beautiful, leggy queen of the school who is condescending, who is patronizing, who thinks that Kamala's culture and family are holding her back because, you know, they're not letting her go out at night. They're not letting her drink alcohol. And isn't it so bad? Isn't it so sad? And that is a level of nuance that I was not expecting to see in a Marvel comic. I'm here to say that this is, it's the first issue. Who knows? But you kind of do because there's something separate going on in this book. There's something deliberately new going on in this book. So I would recommend people check out Ms. Marvel because there's a lot going on right there.
I forget who said it, but that question of whether you're depicting a teenager as an archetype or a teenager as an adult in the making is central to what we've been circling around, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, everybody has – it's something everybody can write about theoretically. Everybody feels like theirs are the most prototypically teenagery things that ever happened to anybody. And so I think you do get those – sometimes it becomes an archetype because people are really just – romanticize. You can't get enough distance from your own experience, and it winds up coming out like it came out of a machine. But then you get these great stories, like Easy A is a great movie. You know, Mean Girls, which Glenn sort of loosely alluded to, is I think a terrific, funny, dark satire that I still refer to in casual conversation all the time.
Yeah, you use the word romanticizing, and it's interesting. Like where I felt you were going with it was romanticizing the pain. There's a tendency, and this was kind of the point I was coming to before, is that we do tend to romanticize the pain of being a teenager in a way, almost because it's fashionable. If you were popular in high school, you hide that.
Right.
There comes a point you don't want to admit that you were popular.
Everybody
in high school.
Everybody says they
weren't.
That
cool you peaked.
In high school.
No, I mean, it's a running joke in a lot of ways where it's like, you know, that whole, oh, I was such a nerd. Yeah, I'll bet you were. Part of it is that everybody feels that way. Because there are things about being a teenager that legitimately suck and that pretty much suck for every teenager. There really does come a point at which it's flipped, at which if you admit that you were popular in high school, you are effectively saying, yeah, I peaked and now I'm more, you know, I'm
now I'm just, and now I victimized, just ordinary. Yeah. And I victimized others.
Right, yeah, that right. I must have been a yeah. mean person if I was yeah. if I was liked in high school.
You know, and I think another reason that these stories get told in the way they get told is that when you're a teenager, you are so awash in hormones that every even moderately negative experience gets just seared into your brain, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like which teenager has not had some questions about their personal appearance, for instance, and decided to get a curly perm on the way out the door to governor's school in the summer?
Yeah.
For example.
As you do.
That's just science. I mean, we remember the memories that are associated with strong emotions. Those are the ones that
right.
we carry around with us. And what is teenagerdom but mm-hmm. strong emotion after strong emotion after strong emotion?
Yeah. But I think a lot of us feel, you know, I personally feel that having been straight up, no, this is not a lie, unbelievably uncool
mm-hmm.
as a teenager,
sure.
like almost like floor fallingly uncool as a teenager. It makes you a person who is a little more prepared to be knocked around a little bit when you're mm-hmm. older, so that when anything good happens to you, you're kind of pleasantly surprised at first. Not anybody, I don't feel that way now, but like at first you have that moment of being like, okay, well, everything's actually okay now. And when you've sort of been the person who gets sort of like, I'll tell you one.
Good.
I'll tell you one.
Go
tell you
on.
One. Okay. Girls in my middle school class paid boys in my class to dance with me at a dance, which I did not find out until later.
Oh.
You can see how I turned out this way. If you're out there, ladies, I appreciate the effort. I can laugh about it now, as
Ouch.
You can see. I'll go home and cry about it later.
Mm-hmm.
But I just want to stop and admire the pall that I've cast over this room, because that story
okay,
is so horrifying.
If it makes you feel any better, it was 10th grade before governor's school. So, and not only was there a curly perm, I decided that summer I was going to get people to call me Tom instead of Trey. Because
oh.
I was so tired of being Trey.
Oh, let's see. We're not going to start sharing stories.
No.
Glenn's like, I'm out.
I will say that there were certain days when the best you could hope for was invisibility. That's
mm-hmm.
what I strived for. Just let me get through without making a wave. I want to get through this entire day without anybody noticing I exist.
I am born with no talent
for
invisibility, man.
I'm visualizing the walking down the hallway between the rows of lockers sequence in your life.
Yeah.
I mean, I figured out fairly early on in high school that my goal, I was never going to be popular, but all I wanted out of life was to be liked. And that has not changed one iota.
No, it definitely has not. So come and find us, social media, find us on the blog. Tell us your story, if you dare. If you dare. Because we're collecting them for all those teenagers out there who think that that their story is the worst. Mm-mm. Mm-mm. You can't hold a candle. Paid. Anyway, and that brings us to our final segment. What
Ten
is making
cents
us? No, it was a dollar. Which I thought was fairly cheap, quite honestly. If you're out there, fellas, you should have asked for more, because mm-hmm. I cannot dance. Anyway, that brings us to our final segment. What is making us happy this week? You guys should just see how completely devastated these guys are at this horrible story. Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, besides the fact that I told that story?
Yeah, that's really all I got. No, I'm actually at a point. February is my month of the year where really all I do is work. This is the time of year where I start to put together the Austin 100. All I'm really able to process is work. So I just have a piece of my work that I'm excited to share. The episode of All Songs Considered that we've recorded this week about the worst songs of all time will have come out. We have brought back for the occasion Carrie Brownstein.
Awesome.
Woo-hoo!
So Carrie Brownstein, who used to blog for NPR Music before she went off to make Portlandia and join the band Wild Flag, at least has enough time on her hands to come back every now and then, rejoin All Songs Considered, and talk about the most repulsive earworms we could conjure. So I'm predicting it hasn't come out yet. By the time this episode airs, it will have come out. I anticipate a strongly mixed reaction, but I'm very, very excited about it. All Songs Considered, the worst songs of all time.
Awesome.
Wonderful. Thank you, Stephen Thompson. Trey Graham, what is making you happy this week?
I finally have a reason to get invested in the NFL draft.
Yeah. And what might that be, Trey Graham?
Well, as most of our audience will be aware, the 6'3", 200-and-some-odd-pound Michael Sam from Mizzou had a conversation with the New York Times and ESPN and a couple of other outlets over the weekend, in which he discussed his sort of experiences as an out gay man in college football locker room. And it's been a fascinating series of conversations. Yeah. And I think what I'm most happy about is the conversation that's been circling around that.
Spoiler alert, none of his teammates cared.
Yeah, right? Shocker. I love all the I mean, and Linda's written about this, but all the anonymous comments from NFL officials who, the culture just cannot handle it.
Yep.
And then the articles that are nothing but like 8,000 tweets from NFL players welcoming him to the league who are very excited. Yeah. The fact that the Missouri football team went to the SEC championship game.
Right. Amazingly, totally distracted by him.
Amazingly, the team was not torn asunder.
Yeah.
And then in other news, there is this revelation, which comes from a performer whose work I have enjoyed in a show that I also quite enjoy. And both of them will be back on your screens shortly.
The most weird thing I've had to do this season is to bite off a man's ear and spit it in his face.
And that, not least because she reminds me of Adele with that cackle, that is Gwendolyn Christie, who plays Brienne of Tarth on Game of Thrones, and that is a tiny little outtake from the 14-minute teaser trailer that HBO dropped. Game of Thrones, Season 4, back with you soon.
Thank you, Trey Graham. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Well, this weekend, the RoboCop remake, for which no one was clamoring, will come out. You can do whatever you want. I'm sure it's great. I'm not sure it's great. I doubt it's great. So instead, if you don't want to go to ourrobocopremake.com. Hmm. This is a crowdsourced film that is actually an hour and a half long. Which is not a shot-for-shot, but a scene-for-scene remake. 50 different filmmakers split the original RoboCop into 50 different parts, recreated individual scenes, strung them all together. It toured briefly, but now it's online, and it's great. Now, I say this to you, and you're saying to me, Glenn, are there musical interludes? Yes, there are.
You read my mind.
Is there animation? Yes, there is. Are there puppets? Of course there are.
You read my mind again.
I think I fell asleep. I was very, very tired, so I might have dreamt the puppets. Pretty sure there's puppets. It is just the tagline.
I'm pretty sure there's puppets, raves Glenn World.
Are there tap dancing skeletons in top hats?
I don't think so, but it's really affectionate, and the tagline is, because if anyone is going to ruin RoboCop, it's us.
Yeah, nice.
I admire that. So ourrobocopremake.com.
I like it. Well, first I wanted to mention something that happened on Twitter last week, which is that Anna Holmes, who's a writer who has written for a bunch of different places, was participating in a conversation with Tell Me More, the NPR show. And so she went to the Bureau in New York City, and she tweeted a couple of pictures of how exciting it was for her to look at the sign-in book at the NPR NYC Bureau. You know, she was like, oh, here's this person's signature. And then she posted a picture that was, here's Emma Thompson's signature. She signed in. I love looking at this book. Look, Emma Thompson signed in. And I looked at it, and there was Emma Thompson's signature. And then in the box next to it, it said, yes, I am. And I was like, I wonder what that is. That's very weird. So I went back to another one of Anna's pictures that showed the top of the columns. And I saw that the column next to name said firm. So Emma Thompson, apparently, I cannot verify this because I didn't ask her. It could have been a forgery. But it appears, and it makes sense, that Emma Thompson signed in at the Bureau in New York by writing Emma Thompson. And then under firm wrote, yes, I am. is pretty much my favorite thing that's ever happened, because it's not being funny on an award show or something. She's just being a random goofball like you or me or any other person who's too much of a tryhard. You know what I mean? Like, I just love that. It's so incredibly great. She's amazing. And I loved that. Speaking of New York, I was in New York this past weekend at the Athena Film Festival, which is run at Barnard College in collaboration with them, and Women in Hollywood, which is a blog about women in Hollywood and film. And I was on a panel called Bechdel Test 2.0, which was designed to take the Bechdel Test, which is the Alison Bechdel's thing that she came up with, that evaluates whether a movie has two women in it who talk to each other, not about a man, basically. And so the point of this panel was to talk about how to treat that, shall we say, as a floor, and what more to ask and expect. And I sat on this panel. It was moderated by Carrie Rickey, who was at the Philadelphia Inquirer for a very, very long time, is a film critic I've read quite a bit of, a woman named Inku Kang, who writes for Women in Hollywood and has also written for some other, for The Village Voice, Katie Rich, who is at Vanity Fair, who's awesome, and Michelle Dean, who is at Flavor Wire, who is also awesome and who sat right next to me. And I kept wanting to high-five Michelle during this panel, and I mostly didn't, but I kept kind of wanting to. It was just a very, very good conversation, and it was a Sunday morning, and it's at Barnard. You know, people who have gotten up on a Sunday morning and come to this panel discussion to talk about the future of female characters and women directors. And the questions were just so smart and so thoughtful. And it's at Barnard. You know, you get there and it says gender inclusive restroom. And I felt so at home because I went to Oberlin. And I felt so at home. Yep. And I felt so at home with these. There actually was this wonderful young woman who was so smart and asked such smart questions and came up and talked to me after, who was actually wearing the A Woman's Place is in the House and Senate shirt. And I was like, you are so awesome. And it was just a really good experience. It was a lovely thing to do. And I was very happy that they asked me. And I met a bunch of very, very kind and friendly listeners to this very podcast. Aww. Who came up and said hello at the end. And I really... There's nothing that's better at the end of a panel discussion where you're afraid that you bored the crap out of everyone than people coming up and saying that they like your work. So so thanks to everybody who came, and thanks to everybody who's on the panel. And I'll give you the Twitter handles in the blog post for this podcast. I'll give you the Twitter handles for all these women because they're all very much worth following. And I had a great experience with all of them. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, S-D-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham, exactly like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica _ Reedy, R-E-E-D-Y. You can follow our producer, Nick Fountain, at Nick Fountain, Nick like Nick Fountain like Fountain. You can follow our esteemed producer emeritus and music director Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band Hello Come In provides our in and out music, which you are bobbing your head to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Now it's time for us to listen to you. Voice your opinions and provide feedback about public radio at nprlistens.org. Your input helps NPR's efforts to bring you the news and stories that matter. Have a say at nprlistens.org.